I live in Delray, about a mile from the beach. I make it there maybe three times a year. I go north to the mountains. Well, actually to the Berkshires, which are only mountains if you live in a place like Florida. And still, summer is the time for beach reads. Now I gotta tell you, I am and have always been a reader. Sometimes a very guilty one, you know, flashlights under the seat, nose in a book to avoid chores or anything unpleasant. And I know there are many, many kinds of reads. There's the reading you had to do for school and still have to do for work. There's the reading you ought to do if you have any desire to be seen as intellectual or erudite, you know, all that real literature and poetry. There's the reading you do to stay culturally current or refuse to do and find yourself justifying your refusal. 50 Shades of Grey, that's that kind of book. There are airport reads. Oh, just give me anything so that I have to wait this hour and don't kill anybody. And there are bedtime chill-out reads. Mysteries, historical fiction, reliable reads, neither challenging nor boring, just right to slow the brain down. Well, a beach read is different. A beach read is special. As Julia Keller said in the Chicago Trib, it is, or it's supposed to be, a brashly captivating and unashamedly shallow novel. It's a love it and leave it book. A story definitely not worth the price of a hardcover. It can be tossed around without guilt, left out to get bleached by the sun, waterlogged by the rain, even chewed on a little bit by the dog. Well, I gotta tell you, even on a Kindle, sitting on a porch in the woods watching the deer, Dan Brown is a perfect beach read. He is, I will admit, as some highbrow reviewers have said, a bit predictable. There are in his books always bad guys, rich, powerful bad guys, working in secret to effect some horrible outcome. The authorities are always useless, in large part because they're so clueless. The race is always on to stop the apocalypse about to be caused by the hubris of the conspirators. And only Robert Langdon is up to the task. Yeah, that tweed-wearing academic whose head holds enough ancient and arcane trivia to see and decipher the clues that are left lying all around. And who also seems to be a chick magnet. For no matter where he is, no matter what he's doing right at his heels, there is always a stunning, strong, brilliant young woman. No ripped bodices here. He is a proper academic. But I gotta say, the man is smart enough always to let her drive. Inferno, the newest book, the one I read this summer, revolves around Dante. And there's plenty there to keep it exciting. There are gorgeous historical sites from Florence to Istanbul. Know the names of those places, and it proves you are not a provincial. And there are new puzzles and brain teasers. So if you get any of the allusions before they're explained in two pages, you really are smarter than a fifth grader. Not bad for a beach read. And I don't want to spoil it, but I have to tell you, in Inferno, it doesn't all work out okay in the end. This time, Langdon is too late, and the apocalypse arrives before anyone even noticed. The seed of this ridiculous, far-fetched plot is the fact of our growing human population. This is the problem that Brown's arrogant genius of a villain manages to solve. He does it, to be sure, in a despicable way. A way that has been reasoned out, though, is nonviolent, and in a twisted kind of way, actually quite fair. There are no wars, no plagues, no haves getting rid of the have-nots. And because the villain wasn't stopped, humankind can only go forward in a new age. Now, this is fiction. Unadulterated, over-the-top, make-believe. The Dante scholarship is not a substitute for a college course. The science is impossible now and implausible in the future. But the problem is real. And that gives me hope. For if summer reads are taking on the most vexing things we know, humankind has still got power it doesn't know. You see, reading along with Brown, our imagination spins through possibilities that actually don't end when the last page is turned. It's a beach read, guys, and beach reads are as essential to our minds and spirits as vitamin B is to our bodies. Flannery O'Connor, the writer, said that a story is a way to say something that can't be said in any other way. You tell a story because a statement would be inadequate. And as one of my mentors, Mariella Holst, once said, and is now painted on my dining room wall, there is truth. I cannot tell you the truth. The truth is in the telling. We know stories are important. We think they're important mostly to our kids. But we forget it's something we never grow out of. Now, if there was a UU bishop, and I were she, I would require of all the faithful a discipline of beach reads. Not as a festival that comes once a year, but as a practice done regularly. Now, if I were bishop, you'd have no reason to obey. So all I can do, all I will do, is try this morning to make a case that fiction is a needed element for the religious life. Stories, myths, legends, well told, told for no purpose at all, but the need to be heard, are essential to your soul and all our lives. You see, I think we adults lose too much when we let go of a child's willingness to pretend. Stepping into fiction the way we drop ourselves into a beach read actually allows us to disengage from the demands of our world, allows us to step back and let our minds play. And if the yarn that has been spun is any good, we find ourselves dreaming the dream on. We take up the what-ifs with images of our own. We stretch the boundaries of possibility. Through stories, our fears take on faces, and we discover what it is we're up against. And then we play with it till we find better and better responses of our own. Okay, I know. Some of you have always found the printed page a torture. No problem. Summer reading doesn't have to be visual. Audiobooks, movies, any format will count, as long as it exercises the skill of pretending, gives us practice in stepping back and seeing larger horizons. For you see, morality begins in the imagination. That is where it is refined and challenged till it grows strong enough to be useful in our day-to-day lives. Stories, my friends, are really not just for children. The Jewish philosopher Martin Buber spent time as a teacher, a professor, and he talked about it in one essay called The Education of Character. And there he tells the story of how he fell into the fatal mistake of giving instructions in ethics. He took his young adult class and presented ethics as formal rules and principles, which any philosopher would. And then he discovered that those rules did not get transformed into character-building substance. As he reflects, he says, "I tried to explain to my pupils that envy is despicable, and at once I felt the secret resistance of those who are poorer than their comrades. I tried to explain that it was wicked to bully the weak, and at once I saw a suppressed smile on the lips of the strong. And I tried to explain that lying destroys life. And something frightful happened. The worst habitual liar of the class produced a brilliant essay on the destructive power of lying." Is it any wonder that Buber went on to write the tales of the Hasidim? Well, here's a story that Buber might have liked. In a town, there lived a very rich man who all thought was a miser. And every time the local rabbi came to his door to collect funds for the poor, the miser would, of course, invite the rabbi in, would offer the rabbi a glass of tea and talk about his business and the community they shared. But when the rabbi started talking about the plight of the poor, the miser would brush him off and tell him the poor people just liked to complain. It wasn't as bad as the rabbi thought. In any case, he had no cash with him in the house just in this moment, and so couldn't give anything today. Maybe next time he saw the rabbi, or maybe the rabbi could come back for a cup of tea. The miser would then graciously escort the rabbi to the door and close it, going back to his warm and comfortable room, and settle in his favorite chair near the fire, very pleased with himself. The rabbi was not so pleased. This wasn't right. He kept trying, went back again and again, only to be given another cup of tea and the very same response. One evening, not knowing what was left to do, the rabbi knocked on the rich man's door. It was that night, cold and miserable. Snow and sleet blew through the streets. The miser asked the rabbi in as usual, but the rabbi said no. This never takes long. And then, as usual, he required after the miser's health and the health of his family and asked him about his business. The miser couldn't send the rabbi away. Of course not. He'd opened the door for him himself. But it was cold and snowing, and he was getting quite uncomfortable on the doorstep of his home. I mean, he'd come to the doors in his slipper and skull cap, dressed in a thin shirt and his house pants. The rabbi, on his way home from the other end of the village, was wearing a warm coat and heavy winter boots, and he just seemed to be talking on and on and on. No, he really didn't want to come in. Thank you very much. No, it was too late for tea. The miser's toes turned to ice and stone. And the rabbi droned on. And he got it. Rabbi, I didn't understand. I didn't know. I never imagined it could be like this. This is miserable. It's horrible. Believe me, I never knew. Something must be done. And the rich man went into his house and returned with a purse full of gold that he handed to the rabbi before he said good night. Yesterday, President Obama spoke on Syria, calling the use of chemical weapons an assault on human dignity and a serious danger to our national security. In his speech, he said this, "In a world with many dangers, this menace must be confronted. And now, after careful deliberation, I have decided that the United States should take military action against Syrian regime targets. This would not be an open-ended intervention. We would not put boots on the ground. Instead, our action would be designed to be limited in duration and scope. But I'm confident that we can hold the Assad regime accountable for their use of chemical weapons, deter this kind of behavior, and degrade their capacity to carry it out. But having made my decision as Commander-in-Chief, based on what I am convinced is our national security interests, I'm also mindful that I'm president of the world's oldest constitutional democracy. I've long believed that our power is rooted not just in our military might, but in our example as a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And that's why I've made a second decision. I will seek authorization for the use of force from the American people's representatives in Congress." Now, those two paragraphs, one right after the other, were not what anyone expected. It left the pundits scrambling, each trying to fit this in to a narrative they knew. Is the president backing down? Or is he stepping up? Or maybe he's just looking for a way not to decide. What will happen when the summer recess is over and the debate begins in Congress? In our Congress? And how will the world understand this 10-minute speech? Because they heard it. It was even broadcast in real time with translation on national TV in Syria. If this were a beach read, you might feel free to put your imagination to use. If this were a screenplay instead of real-time news, what end would you write? What would you have happen on Monday or Monday week or next month? Who would your fictional president turn out to be? A hawk or a dove? Would he be weak or strong, a savvy political manipulator, or a muscular commander-in-chief? What events could you, would you, cascade out from those two paragraphs that don't quite fit? Me? I'd write my fictional president something like that rabbi at the door. I'd make him an earnest, thoughtful, principled character who believed he knew what was right and one night, fed up with the old games and unwilling to give up, went as far as he could and then stood still. In my screenplay, I'd write in some breaking dawn moment when this imaginary president realized that he was holding an important principle in each hand, neither of which he was willing to let go. And I'd have him stand still long enough for business as usual to sputter and stall, for all the other characters in the play to stop and wonder. In my screenplay, that pause would be enough for the plot to turn, the soundtrack to change, and something new to emerge. Me, I'd let the confusion cook them all till hard lines and hard hearts were softened. The confusion might give birth to a new consensus. And this experiment called democracy could work to move us all beyond the rule of presidents and kings and tyrants towards a safer world. Now, I know real life ain't nothing like fiction. But I also know that without fiction, without the human imagination, there's little reason to hope. There are so many of us now on this green-blue ball. We are so interconnected that the stakes from now on will always be high. And when the old ways fail to solve our problems, when we need something new, it will only come if there have already been enough of us humans disciplined in the skill of disengaging from the demands of the world and knowing how to wonder and dream the dream on. So friends, practice hope by doing your summer reading all year long. Take it as a spiritual practice and do it well, intentionally and fully. You may help move the world along.